Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll look at the silver tsunami when it comes to healthcare. An aging population is putting more strain on hospitals and emergency rooms. Staff are dealing with those living longer with complex illnesses and dementia. Also, a Chicago migrant recently deported to Venezuela says conditions in detention are inhumane. His removal from the U.S. left his wife and children here alone, struggling financially. His wife says she's ready to self-deport. We'll hear more from them. BB guns today can look more realistic than what they used to, and that can prove deadly in confrontations with police. More on that story. We'll also get a tour of a Lustron home and hear about research into dust storms. And we visit the world of the Drum and Bugle Corps. It's quite competitive, as we'll learn. That and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Long emergency room waits in the U.S. are common, especially for older patients. Some wait for many hours, even days, before they get a hospital bed. In cooperation with the Associated Press, Side Effects Public Media's Ben Thorpe reports experts say things will only get worse as the country braces for what they're calling a silver tsunami, that is, an aging population that may come with complex diseases and more dementia cases.
Tracy Bolhan flips through old photos of her dad, Bill Spear, at their vacation home in Indiana. In one photo, her father wears a t-shirt in front of a sweaty bucket of beers.
He does have my shirt on. Yeah, Pops, the man, the myth, the legend.
Bolhan misses her dad. She even keeps some of his old voicemails.
I got to know what I need to complain about. Can you help me? I got to know.
Spear passed away last year after a long struggle with dementia. They routinely ended up in the emergency room. During one stay, he spent 12 hours in the ER of Endeavor Health in Naperville, Illinois, waiting for a psych evaluation.
He was strapped down. There was nothing he could do. So he was like banging his head, you know, like doing the things where he was kind of thrashing around in the bed.
The hospital said they wouldn't comment on Spear's experience, citing patient privacy. Bolhan didn't know it then, but her dad's ER experience is so common it has a name, ER boarding. In 2022, the most recent year we have data for, 3 million visits to an ER that led to a hospital admission had a wait of 4 hours or longer before getting a regular hospital bed. That's according to an analysis by the Associated Press and Side Effects Public Media. Data suggests that half of the patients who were boarded were 65 or older. Experts say, at this rate, it's unlikely things will get better.
The population is substantially older. People have way more complicated illnesses. There are people living longer and longer with the complexities of having had cancer, congestive heart failure, chronic lung disease.
That's Arjun Venkatesh, who studies emergency medicine at Yale. Other experts warn of a silver tsunami of patients that will hit ERs. That's because the rates of dementia in the U.S. are expected to grow over the next few decades. Venkatesh says part of the problem is a lack of staffed hospital beds.
So we have about just as many hospital beds in America today as we did 20 years ago. The reason that's a problem is that emergency department visits are up 30% to 40% over that time.
And he says hospitals tend to prioritize scheduled care patients, whose insurance companies will reimburse them for things like cancer care and orthopedic surgeries. That means that there aren't incentives to bring patients from backed up ERs into a hospital bed on another floor. That leaves patient caregivers in a tough spot. They say when they're in crisis, they don't know where else to go besides the ER.
It's where you end up because it's like, what do I do? It's an acute behavior. I need to do something.
This is Nancy Frageau. In 2024, she took her husband, Michael Riemann, to the emergency room in Kankakee, Illinois, 3 separate times. One of those times led to an emergency room stay longer than 10 hours waiting for specialized care.
You know, it's hard enough for anyone to be in the ER, but I cannot imagine someone with dementia being in there because that was so hard for him. I was there most of the time and he just kept saying, when am I going? What's happening? Because he didn't understand.
Frageau and most of the families we spoke to do not blame the nurses and doctors for the long stays. They say the problem appears to be much deeper. Several national organizations, including the American College of Emergency Physicians, have been advocating for systemic changes on the policy and hospital levels to tackle ER boarding. But those groups say the effort hasn't moved the needle far enough. Tracy Ballhan says the emergency room experience has stuck with her.
People didn't look at my dad as a man when we were going through the worst of it. It didn't feel to me like he was being treated with any dignity. And that, if anything could change, that would be the change that I would want to see.
More than that, caregivers like Ballhan say their experiences leave them worried that the U.S. health system isn't prepared to handle a population of dementia patients that is only expected to grow. I'm Ben Thorpe, Side Effects Public Media.
What's your dream home? For a lot of people, the answer is something I can afford. 75 years ago, it was this type of demand for starter housing that led to the creation of the Lustron House. These tiny prefab homes are still found, scattered throughout neighborhoods in the Midwest. What made them so popular is what makes them so easy to spot. They're made completely of pastel enameled steel panels. Cindy and Larry Mine opened their doors to showcase their quirky metal home in Mount Morris. And the Rockford architect Ashley Sarver and Lustron home expert Val Olofsson tagged along.
So you build your slab, then a big semi would pull up to your property. You'd be handed a book on how to put your Lustron together.
Okay.
And then you'd put it together.
And how long would it take most people?
The record for putting the Lustron together is 39 hours.
39 hours.
So
what would it average? What would it take me? Like how many months?
A couple of weeks. And everything that you needed for the house was on that truck. The windows, the interior, the HVAC system, which is one of their bad designs. One of their interesting designs was a dishwasher that converted to a clothes washer.
Interesting.
I don't have one.
It's really interesting because everything is enameled steel, from the roof to the walls. Now, the exterior, as you can see, are squares. But on the interior, it's still enameled steel, but it's vertical panels. So if you want to hang art, you use magnets.
You can see that.
You guys have magnets in there?
Yeah. Okay.
And so you never have to paint your house.
Yeah.
You can take a hose, wash it down, clean it.
No, you can't do that inside.
No, you can't do that inside.
And how long have you been living here in the Lustron?
We've been here for 7 years. And overall, we're extremely happy because we're senior citizens. It's one level. There's no steps. One of the negative things is the storage is a little hard to come by here. So you'll see a lot of science stuff setting out, but that's how we live.
Well, you usually do not see a lot of changes or modifications with the Lustron. Okay. Because, I mean, literally it's put together like a puzzle.
Uh-huh.
You know, each piece fits together. So by making a modification, then it'll snowball.
Overall, the concept of the house is excellent.
Oh, yeah.
It's just... would like to be able to insulate it just a little bit better and wish it didn't cost so much to replace the windows.
The whole conversation is kind of coming back up again about prefabricated homes or modular homes because we have the same issue that we had basically after World War II where there's a housing shortage and it's too expensive to build them kind of the normal way. So we're looking at all these ways that you can either prefabricate or modular, you know, construct it mostly somewhere else and then just bring it on site again.
Yeah, it's been a really neat thing living in it. It's been a hoot. And like I say, when we go in, you'll see the pictures on the wall, everything. We got a lot of stuff hanging on the walls.
Well, can we take a look?
Sure, sure.
We love it.
So, but as you can see, like these lovely built-ins that were all part of the original design.
So the shelving was included, yeah.
Okay.
We found out one other thing, that for cleaning purposes, alcohol is by far the best.
I do have to drink when I'm cleaning, too.
you don't want to drink this alcohol.
So overall, though, you're happy here? You like the house?
By far, you know, like I said, the few little quirky things, but it's really nice. It's a good starter home. I think I heard somebody saying that at the beginning. It's a good starter home, and it's a good finishing home. It's a good home for two old people like us.
Cindy and Larry Mine at their Lustron home in Mount Morris. You're listening to Statewide. Since President Trump took office, we've been hearing a lot about federal agents arresting immigrants outside schools, on their way to work, and after appointments in immigration court. But we don't have many firsthand accounts about what happens next. Adriana Cardona-McGeegan brings us the story of one Chicago asylum seeker during his time in detention.
¿Cómo has estado? ¿Cómo estás? ¿Acabaste de llegar a tu casa?
Sí, el día de ayer.
Marcos was in ICE custody for nearly 3 months. I tracked him down after he got deported back to Venezuela in June. He agreed to tell me what happened in detention.
Okay, bueno,
He's calling from his mom's house in Caracas. His wife, Maria, is also on the call with their 2-year-old.
Papi!
Hola, mi corazón. Mi vida.
She's connecting from their Southside Chicago apartment, where the couple was starting to build a life since they arrived in 2023. They have 2 other kids, 6 and 9. WBC is not using their full names to protect them from retaliation. Marcos was arrested this spring by ICE agents after he dropped his kids off outside their school. On his way out, federal agents surrounded his car and told him they had an immigration arrest order. Marcos says the agents never said why they were arresting him. He was confused. He and his wife had been following immigration law. They were applying for asylum, had work permits and driver's licenses. Marcos says many thoughts ran through his head at that moment. His kids inside the school, his journey to the U.S., and how excited he and his wife were after buying a car just the day before. Marcos says the agents then took him to a Walmart parking lot. There, he says they handcuffed him and shackled him. Then they took pictures as if he had been arrested there. Marcos didn't understand what was going on. But immigration officials had been sharing photos of detained immigrants on social media. They are often accused of having criminal records. That morning was the beginning of a 3-month odyssey. ICE kept trying to brand Marcos as a criminal. He says he endured terrible conditions at several detention facilities. At his first stop, a processing center in Illinois, he says he was questioned as if he had ties to gangs, which he denied. He was asked about his tattoos. Marcos says one is of the Atlantic Ocean, another one is a rosary. There is also a tattoo of his kid's name. He says, just because I'm from Venezuela, it doesn't mean I belong to a gang. Then he says federal agents started hunting for evidence to suggest he was breaking the law. They unlocked his phone and questioned him about transactions in his bank account. I told them I'm a DJ. I work as an Uber driver, he says. I used to work at a McDonald's. Marcos insisted, I've never been arrested in the U.S. I've never had a DUI. I thought you were only deporting criminals. He told them he had followed the rules all along. He waited in Mexico for an appointment with immigration before entering the U.S. to start his asylum application. But he says the agents only ramped up the pressure.
Dime la verdad, si no te voy a enviar para el SECO.
Marcos was told if he didn't cooperate, he would be sent to this notorious prison in El Salvador, where hundreds of immigrants have been deported since Trump took office. That threat followed him from detention center to detention center. For nearly 3 months, they zigzagged him across the Midwest, the South, and the Southwest. He says he was locked up in 10 different facilities.
Me llevan a Kansas.
Transferred in vehicles that look like cars to transport dogs. His hands and feet always shackled. Marcos found legal help with the Chicago-based National Immigrant Justice Center. His attorney says locating him between transfers and communicating with ICE was extremely hard. The conditions were brutal. He says they made him sleep on metal benches with the lights on the whole night in Missouri. He sat on a bus all day in shackles, not knowing where he would be taken next. He didn't have enough to eat. He was in pain without medicine. Then, about 2 months into his detention, Marcos' asylum application was denied. He lost all hope of seeing his wife and three children anytime soon. ICE had what it needed to deport him. From then on, his biggest fear was being framed as a criminal. In one Texas detention facility, officials called me and another young man saying that immigration had sent a message that we were with El Tren de Aragua. That's a criminal gang that originated in Venezuela and that Trump says is invading the U.S. Marcos says he was forced to wear a red jumpsuit, the kind they typically put on violent offenders. He remembers being told by a guard, I should fear you. But to Marcos, this made no sense. He had no criminal record in the U.S., and he says he has no arrest records elsewhere. He was an asylum seeker who held multiple jobs in Chicago to support his young family, and now he was labeled a violent criminal. Marcos says the worst part was the toll on his mental health. There was the loneliness, the uncertainty, the inability to speak with his family for days, sometimes weeks. He heard about a Venezuelan man who died by suicide in one of these detention centers. WBC couldn't confirm this, but news reports and advocates say deaths and health emergencies in detention centers have increased this year. I asked ICE and the Department of Justice why Marcos was arrested. Did they have any criminal evidence against him? No answer. The Department of Homeland Security says any claims about poor conditions are false. They say all detainees are provided with proper meals and medical care. Marcos was finally deported back to Venezuela last month. Federal agents never pinned a crime on him. Marcos is free. He and his wife, Maria, are relieved and video chat daily. But the family is separated, and Maria is alone in Chicago with three children, afraid and unemployed. In the apartment, the couple once thought would be the start of their American dream. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEZ News.
More on that story ahead on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We've been following a couple seeking asylum in the U.S. until the husband was arrested and later deported under President Trump's mass deportation efforts. The husband spent nearly 3 months in detention, alone and with three young kids. His wife is out of work, and sometimes they don't have enough to eat. She fears getting arrested herself. Things are so bad, she's ready to self-deport to Venezuela. She enrolled in Trump's self-deportation program and is set to leave. Adriana Cardona Magiga brings us her story.
Maria says in the last 3 months since her husband Marcos got arrested and deported, she's lost everything. She shows me around her kitchen. Her fridge is almost empty. She got rid of her furniture. She also sold her car. She's alone all day inside her apartment with a 2, a 6, and a 9-year-old. The kids haven't left the apartment in weeks. They don't go outside to play. Her 9-year-old mostly just lays around. He looks sad. It's all taking a toll on her mentally.
Bueno, yo no sufría de nada. Ahora tengo migraña. Ahora sufro de depresión y de ansiedad.
I used to be healthy. Now I have migraines, depression, and anxiety. I can't sleep at night, she says.
No me da sueño.
Marcos hasn't been around since March. He was arrested by ICE agents after he dropped his kids off outside their Southside Elementary School. We're not using Marcos and Maria's real name because they fear retaliation. Maria was in shock, describing the first time Marcos called after he was arrested. Marcos ended up spending nearly 3 months in detention. He was zigzagged across 10 different detention facilities in the Midwest, the South, and the Southwest. His asylum application was denied while he was in detention. He describes his odyssey now that he's been deported back to Venezuela.
en un cuarto frío con una silla de metal, que era, el frío era horrible, nunca apagan la luz. Y si uno se molestaba, lo enviaba para el hoyo.
He says the conditions were brutal. Officials made him sleep on a metal bench with the lights on the whole night in a facility in Missouri. He sat on a bus all day in shackles, not knowing where he'll be taken next. He didn't have enough to eat. He was in pain without medicine. He says federal agents also tried to pin him as a criminal and a gang member and threatened to send him to a maximum security prison in El Salvador. Meanwhile, Maria was in Chicago, worrying and alone. She says the kids are asking about their dad. Maria looks tired, sleep deprived. For a while, she had to find a babysitter so that she could work the night shift at a meatpacking plant. Her husband's arrest made no sense to her. Marcos doesn't have a criminal record, and the couple has been following the rules. They crossed the U.S.-Mexico border legally after getting an appointment to apply for asylum in the U.S. Like millions, they fled Venezuela's poverty and violence. Marcos almost died crossing the Darien Gap getting here. He being alive is a miracle, she says. After being bused from Texas to Chicago and living in a migrant shelter, they found an apartment. With a pending asylum application, the couple got work permits. Maria found a job at the meatpacking plant. Marcos worked at a McDonald's, then he was an Uber driver and a DJ. Maria shows me videos of Marcos DJing a kid's birthday party.
Ah, él está disfrazado ahí con una máscara y con unos guantes de luces.
Here he's wearing a mask and dancing with children, she says. Life began to fall into place. Until her husband's arrest in March.
Señorita Adriana, ¿cómo está? No, todavía tengo ese problema del trabajo, pues. Me quedé sin trabajo, ahorita tengo una deuda que tengo que pagar.
She called me one day to tell me she had been sick and had lost her job. And the bills kept coming, rent, food.
Bueno, me siento como destrozada, con ganas de no sé qué hacer. En realidad, como digo, soy sola.
Maria says she's devastated, unsure of what to do. She feels lonely. She's the only one responsible for her kids.
Antes éramos un equipo, pues ya ahorita soy yo con mis hijos. Y pues, ¿qué más? Estar aquí, a ver qué sucede.
We used to be a team, she says. He was a pillar in this family. Her kids missed school for more than a month. She feared getting arrested. She doesn't have a family in Chicago to lean on. She relies on mutual aid volunteers to help with food and rent money when they can. All of this pushed her to make a drastic decision. She wants to self-deport. She's given up on the dream she and Marcos had together.
Hola, Anaís, y a toda la comunidad de TikTok que tiene este mismo problema, que no tienen pasaporte, están en Estados Unidos.
Maria's been going on TikTok to get advice on how to go back home, but she doesn't have a passport. Venezuela doesn't have a consulate or embassy anywhere in the U.S. where she can get one. Some influencers also share information about the Trump administration's new self-deportation initiative. That's what she's decided to do. She's using the app the Biden administration created to help bring people like her into the country. The Trump administration retooled it to remove people. Trump has also promised applicants help getting home and $1,000 once they arrive. We don't have exact numbers on how many immigrants are taking the offer. Immigration officials claim that tens of thousands of people have used the app to self-deport, but didn't provide a real count. Chicago volunteers and service providers are starting to see more asylum seekers considering this option. Experts say people should consult with a lawyer before enrolling. Maria already applied.
Me dice gracias por inscribirse para salir voluntariamente de los Estados Unidos a través del programa CPIBON. Nos estamos comunicando con usted mediante el correo.
She's already got a confirmation email from the government and is scheduled to leave at the end of July. She's anxious to go. She has a $700 gas bill she owes and is afraid she'll be evicted. She sends emails every day asking the government for updates.
O sea, no pregunté lo del dinero que dan porque no, lo que quiero es irme. O sea, no sé si lo dan, no sé si será verdad, mentira, no sé.
And it's not about the money, she says. She doesn't care about the stipend. I asked her if she's confident the government will hold up its end of the bargain, that she will arrive safely in Venezuela with her three children, without getting separated along the way or ending up in a detention center. She says, of course not.
No.
She doesn't trust the government, and she's afraid. But she has no other options, and she just doesn't want to live in the United States without Marcos anymore. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
The Illinois Department of Transportation is seeking feedback on a proposal to build a rural expressway from the Metro East to southern Illinois. Will Bauer reports feedback is the latest effort to make the Southwest Connector a reality.
IDOT says it wants to hear from Illinoisans in the southern and southwest parts of the state to better inform the highway corridor that will run from Waterloo near the Metro East to Murfreesboro in the southern tip. Carrie Nelson is IDOT's program development engineer based in Carbondale.
We want to hear what your transportation problems are. We want to know the goals of the region. Economic development, access to health care, improved tourism, improved freight network, regional connectivity.
The feedback will be used in what's called a planning and environmental linkages study. Overall, the $6 million analysis is expected to wrap up in 2027. Illinoisans can submit their thoughts online, via email, or by mail. IDOT will take the public's feedback until August 18th. I'm Will Bauer.
Science has been studying the growing of crops for a long time, but the study of soil is relatively new. Researchers are finding there's a lot to be learned about how farming has impacted soil over the decades. And as Jim Meadows reports, that research could be greatly helped by the discovery of soil samples over a century old.
On a Sunday morning in August of 2018, University of Illinois soil scientist Andrew Margonaut drove out to a dilapidated barn on the campus farm. Inside, using a headlamp to pierce the darkness, Margonaut discovered a treasure trove.
I realized within about 5 minutes of walking through these cobwebbed, very dark hallways that there were row upon row, shelf upon shelf of soils, and that these were the original soils taken in the mapping of the state.
There were thousands of soil samples stored in mason jars and other sealed containers going back as far as the 1860s. The soil, taken from nearly every Illinois county, mostly in the early 1900s, was used to map soil types and help farmers determine growing conditions. The collection was orphaned in 2003 after the death of the last researcher to work with it. Professor Margonaut says his rediscovery sent his mind reeling with the research possibilities.
I didn't sleep for about two nights because I was so excited by all the things that we could answer.
Margonaut is contacting farmers and landowners so he can take new soil samples in the same locations. He wants to study how the soil has changed over more than a century to learn about long-term changes in nutrients, microbial activity, and soil stability. That's a rare opportunity. U.S. Department of Agriculture soil scientist Mark Liebig says the soil samples in most soil archives are less than 40 years old.
The average human lifespan now is right around 73 years. With the exception of a few places across the globe, we really don't know how the soil changes over that duration of time.
Liebig says he believes many older soil archives that did exist have been lost either forever or until they're found again. At Penn State University, another collection showed up in a storage closet 4 years ago. The samples date from 1915 and 1933 from a now-demolished test plot on campus. Rita Grafe with Penn State's Pasto Agricultural Museum says nowadays they can analyze the soils in new ways, even reviving the soil's dormant microbes.
But we need to preserve these collections because in the future, there might be technologies that let us further understand what was happening in the soil then so that we can make decisions going forward.
We also have the marl plot samples going back to 1904 up here as well.
Okay.
So it's a
At the University of Illinois today, thousands of jars of soil line shelves in a much newer barn. Margonaut picks one up.
And this one, for example, this is a good example of a jar where the label is not in great shape, as you can see.
But a little paper inside the jar gives more information. Marconat is using all that data to reach out to landowners and ask permission to take new soil samples at more than 450 specific locations. So far, he's gotten around 60. One of those new samples comes from John Kiefner's farm southwest of Chicago.
I see it as an avenue for me to maybe get more educated and become a little smarter. I'm really curious to see how this soil has changed from 1957 to 2024.
Kiefner adopted no-till farming more than three decades ago. He hopes to learn that he's actually improved his soil, or at least not harmed it. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jim Meadows.
Dust storms have been increasing in frequency in central Illinois in the past few years, but it's unclear whether climate change, farming practices, or something else is driving it. Ben Howell has more.
May 16th was a day of surprising weather. The Friday was warm, a high of 84 and partly cloudy conditions, a fairly normal day, until a dust storm blew its way from Bloomington to Chicago. Dust storms have been increasing in recent years, although they are not usually as large as the one on May 16th. Illinois State climatologist Trent Ford says just because we don't understand the weather around us doesn't automatically mean it is climate change.
And I think it's prudent to evaluate, you know, the role of climate change in all of our weather hazards to know what's going to happen or what is happening and how to prepare for it. But I think it's also important to say, okay, this isn't necessarily a climate change signal.
The two major ingredients for a dust storm are wind and dry soil. Ford says data suggests the state is actually getting wetter springs and wind is holding steady. Ford says the difficulty for him and other experts lies in predicting the storms. They know how and why a dust storm occurs, but not when one will happen.
What was the difference essentially between what happened when we had the big dust storm and the day before, where we were equally as dry and equally as windy, but we didn't get the dust storm?
Ford says the ideal reason for predicting dust storms would be to better warn the public about the conditions. Meanwhile, farmers have been encouraged to do their part to better protect their soil and keep it from leaving the fields. One possible solution is cover crops planted during the off-season that enhance soil nutrients and hold it together. Nick Frillman is a local food systems and small farms educator out of the University of Illinois Extension in McLean County. Frillman says about 7% of corn and 17% of soybean fields use cover crops between fall harvest and spring planting. He says some farmers resist.
There is a non-zero cost for cover cropping. You're looking at cost of seed, and then we're looking at cost of fuel to drive the planter across the field, and then we're looking at the farmer's time, none of which come in high supply these days, right?
Farmers who use cover crops look to future harvest sizes and the environment. They hope for a return on their investment. Frillman says the story is similar for no-till farming. They sow seeds directly into residue of the previous crop and leave topsoil undisturbed.
If we leave that residue on the surface, there's an overwhelming body of research that shows that there is increased organic matter in the topsoil compared to tillage-based planting systems where there's less organic matter in that top fraction of the soil profile.
No-till farming also supports weed suppression. Surface residue prevents weed growth beneath it. Another possible solution to helping protect farmland and reduce the risk of dust storms is enforcement. Robert Hirschfeld is water director at the Prairie Rivers Network. He says practices like cover crops and no-tillage should be more than voluntary.
Other industries, other major industries in America, we regulate. We pass laws, create rules that require them to clean up their pollution or to limit the amount of pollution they're putting in the water or the air. We simply haven't done that for agriculture.
Hirschfeld says farming on erodible land leads to water runoff and chemicals leaving farmland and entering water sources. He says it makes sense dust storms have increased.
It's remarkable that we have turned a state that was prairie into a state where you can have dust bowls, but it's also the logical consequence of farming in this way.
Mike Kelly farms roughly 4,000 acres near Lexington. He started farming in 1988 and almost immediately started using no-till and cover crops. Kelly says he knows they help reduce dust storms, especially as he watched the soil on his land remain still on May 16th.
I think it'd be hard to argue that really no-till, strip-till, and especially cover crops, I think it'd be hard to argue that they don't significantly reduce wind erosion.
Dave Stutzman also farms out of Lexington. His recollection of the May 16 storm was similar, but overshadowed. His mind wandered to public reaction to his profession.
Every time something like that happens, it's, you know, it's, it is somewhat sad just because you know that people are going to think that it's all farmers' fault.
Stutzman says no farmer he knows is trying to destroy their soil. He says they want to keep their land for generations to come. I'm Ben Howell.
There's more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. Thanks for being with us on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A bill that could help bring pilot programs for overdose prevention sites to Illinois failed to pass during the recent legislative session. Isabella Nieto breaks down what happened and why it matters.
Overdose prevention advocate Melissa Hernandez is giving a tour.
Somebody will come into a overdose prevention site with their substance of choice, right? And they're going to stop over here.
She's standing next to a metal table with a small tray that holds a tourniquet, syringe, and alcohol swabs. It's surrounded by blue privacy curtains. This is a model of an overdose prevention site, or OPS. It's at the Illinois State House. Hernandez is the executive director of the Puerto Rico Project. The organization provides harm reduction services in Chicago, including sterile use kits similar to ones that would be available at an OPS.
They're going to choose the paraphernalia, however form of method that they're going to use, right? Let's just say they're going to grab some syringes and stuff. They're going to come over here, sit down, and they're going to prepare their stuff.
These sites offer people who are most likely to use drugs a safe space to use substances they already have. An OPS can also connect people to resources, like housing services or addiction treatment. Hernandez, along with other harm reduction advocates, visited the State House in April to show their support for legislative steps aimed at bringing overdose prevention sites to Illinois. Democratic Representative LaShawn Ford represents Chicago's West Side and has filed OPS legislation before. He filed a bill during this legislative session that would introduce a pilot program for an overdose prevention site.
Our plan is to have a real solid bill that has been vetted by the advocates and the legislature to cover all our bases.
Ford says he plans to file new bill language that streamlines his plan for the pilot programs before the next legislative session. At a committee hearing in March, Jim Katchuk from the Illinois Sheriff's Association raised concerns about legal immunity for people who use the sites. Ford says his new plan will address those concerns.
We've narrowed that to the mission of the site, which means that we protect the users of the site from being prosecuted for using. So it's streamlined and it's singly focused on those that are using the services.
A state opioid settlement board approved up to $18 million in funding in January to set up a pilot program for overdose prevention sites, but acknowledged that legislative changes might be needed. A project funded by the Illinois Department of Human Services surveyed residents on Chicago's West Side in 2021 about the potential benefits of an overdose prevention site. Close to 90% of survey participants said an OPS would help. About 20% reported concerns about an OPS on the West Side, including the fear that it could put a strain on the area's healthcare and social services. Chelsea LaLiberte Barnes is co-chair of the Illinois Harm Reduction and Recovery Coalition. She says one potential model for an OPS is to connect it with an existing healthcare center.
We want it to be a comfortable space that the community is not afraid to engage with, because making sure that we design this for the dignity of the community is really crucial to making people being able to access it.
There are overdose prevention sites in several other states, which Barnes says can serve as examples for one in Chicago. She says she understands why people could have mixed feelings about an overdose prevention site, but the primary focus is to save lives.
So whether or not we want people to use drugs, they are going to use drugs. Whether or not they're going to use drugs in safe environments, that is up to us. We know what we need to do to be able to address that piece.
The bill sponsored by Representative Ford didn't make it to the House or Senate floor for a vote. His new plan still has to be filed and introduced before lawmakers can reconsider the pilot program.
Isabella Nieto with that report. Well, this week, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed two laws aimed at addressing gun violence, as Mahbub Iqbal reports.
The governor signed a measure adding civil penalties for people who don't properly store their guns at home. The law also established a shorter time frame for people to report lost or stolen guns, which is now 2 days. Pritzker calls it a common sense measure that's been shown to reduce accidental shootings.
Mandating secure and responsible storage is a critical first step in combating these problems and protecting our communities. If we can prevent even one death or accident through these measures, they will have been more than worth it.
Also taking effect is a mandate that every law enforcement agency go through a federal gun tracing program. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Member station WGLT has been reporting on guns in Bloomington-Normal, and in this story, they look at BB guns. Today's are more sophisticated and also resemble real weapons, Ryan Denham reports.
Before his fatal confrontation with police, 15-year-old Cole Turner of Normal had something to show off to his friends, his new gun. It wasn't a real gun, but it sure looked like it. The Sig Sauer P365 BB gun is nearly identical to its bullet-firing twin. Authorities say his friends saw it up close and thought it was real. So did police. 2 days after Turner bought the gun, Bloomington police say he pointed it at officers who had cornered him in an apartment parking lot.
What's going on today, man? Why are you like this?
What you mean? I ain't doing nothing.
Okay, why don't you just drop the gun?
They shot and killed him. Prosecutors who reviewed the case say the officers were legally justified in part because they couldn't tell the gun was fake.
There are no markings on this weapon which identifies the gun as a replica of a real weapon, nor identifies it as a non-lethal handgun.
That's Police Chief Jamal Symington speaking at a press conference after the shooting.
In this incident, 4 of our community members observed this individual with a gun. All 4 feared for their safety, as did the involved officers.
Turner was not the only young person in Bloomington-Normal with an imitation gun. Local police say they're encountering them more frequently, often among young people for whom guns are a status symbol. Like all commodities, fakes can be an easy way to get what you want. And unlike real guns, imitations, which can threaten others and get you killed, are barely regulated. And even those regulations have loopholes.
Honestly, this is not an area that I've seen a lot of attention focused on.
Adam Skaggs is chief counsel and vice president at the Giffords Law Center to prevent gun violence.
There is more attention, whether you want to say on the left and the right, but from all sides of the political issue, I think there's much more concern about regulating actual firearms than there is about toy or imitation firearms.
One group that is paying attention is Bloomington and Normal Police. Bloomington Police spokesperson Officer Bryce Jansen says they see fake guns frequently.
There's many cases a year where, you know, a juvenile will have a realistic gun sitting on the back seat or in their backpack, something of that nature.
It happens enough that Normal Police collect and share intelligence about people known to have realistic-looking fake guns. That's according to Normal Police spokesperson Officer Brad Park.
Because the officers need to know, okay, we know that this person was located having an airsoft gun that looked like a realistic firearm, because the goal is we know they're going to use that gun to try to make it as if they had a real firearm.
Authorities say Turner bought his Sig Sauer BB gun 2 days before his fatal shooting February 25th. It's unclear where he bought it. State police investigated his death but has not responded yet to WGLT's request for documents related to the case. Authorities say Turner's BB gun didn't even work, suggesting it was not bought new. But had he wanted to, Turner could have bought a new one on Sig Sauer's website for $130 with free shipping. He would have had to check a single box to certify he was at least 21 years old. Sig Sauer markets the BB gun as a low-cost alternative to its popular bullet-firing sibling, complete with a blowback slide that mimics the real thing. Sig Sauer did not respond to a request for comment for this story. Ostensibly, a BB gun like this is meant for training and target practice. So we wanted to know, if they're used for training and target practice, why the heck do they need to look so realistic?
Because people want them all over the world. They want those things.
That's Richard Pearson, executive director of the Illinois State Rifle Association.
You have to look at the other side of it, the people who are doing the right thing. We always take action against people. We want to take action against people who do the wrong thing, but then we punish the people who do the right things.
There are federal regulations that apply to certain lookalikes, like toy guns and water guns, that requires bright markings, often orange, or another obvious indicator that it's fake. That requirement does not apply to traditional BB guns, paintball guns, or pellet-firing air guns. States vary in how they regulate them. Illinois merely prohibits sales to those under age 13. Here's Adam Skaggs again with the Giffords Law Center.
Our position is that if you're selling a product that any observer is going to think is a firearm, but is not, it'd be appropriate to require that those have, you know, bright colors, so that they wouldn't be mistaken for a weapon.
Richard Pearson with the State Rifle Association says that wouldn't work.
Well, we tried that. All they do is paint it black. You go out buy a can of black spray paint, they spray the thing.
Pearson says it's parents who should control juvenile access to imitation guns like this. Make sure they're trained on what to do or what not to do.
So we've had one incident here among the millions and millions that are out there. So I think one of the things we can't do is we can't make a law because of one or two incidents. You just can't do that.
Except it's not one or two incidents. Nationally, there were 364 people injured or killed in police shootings involving a BB or replica gun between 2015 and 2020. That's according to the Center for Gun Violence Solutions at Johns Hopkins. Here's Adam Skaggs again with Giffords.
One serious concern that these kind of look-alike firearms have is that they can be mistaken for a real gun, and whether by law enforcement or by another individual, if you see someone carrying what you think is a gun, you may perceive a threat.
Ryan Dinham with that story. While most high school football fields sit quiet in the dog days of summer, one in the Metro East is bursting with music and motion. Brian Munoz takes us inside the world of drum corps.
After we have our unison, side two push.
More than 150 people fill a St. Louis area high school football field for practice in the humid Midwestern heat. Instructions and feedback echo down from the press box.
Can you make sure that you're sustaining your beautiful quality of sound all the way to the end of that release?
But these aren't football drills, and despite people holding flags and brass instruments, this isn't a local marching band. This is drum corps. The Boston Crusaders, who you're hearing from, are part of a multi-million dollar activity dubbed Marching Music's Major League. Think of a professional marching band, but largely without woodwinds.
It's Broadway on a football field.
That's Jim Sturgeon, a longtime judge with Drum Corps International, the nonprofit that oversees the activity's competitive circuit.
It is what you would experience in a theater. It has many of the same elements. It can have colors, it can have different costumes, it can have set pieces, it can have all of these things, and lots of enrichment from a musical standpoint.
Most corps are made up of college-age performers, and they come from all over the world. After months of auditions, rehearsals, and weekend camps, the corps hit the road for a national summer tour. Jeffrey Turk is a Boston Crusaders Color Guard member from Cape Girardeau.
It's not just marching band, it is something that transcends it so much. And it's the reason why we spend all this money and go leave our homes for months at a time and go to who knows where just so we can do it over and over again. It's because we love it, and it's a completely different experience.
That passion for performance is steeped in decades of evolution. Drum and bugle corps trace their roots to the military, where they once served as battlefield signaling units. But as radios replaced bugles, they later turned into neighborhood ensembles. The Belleville Black Knights were one of those groups. That's the corps performing William Walton's Crown Imperial during a 1973 show in Butler, Pennsylvania. The Metro East Drum Corps was formed in 1953 and quickly gained national prominence for its precision on the field. Bill Knapp joined the Belleville Black Knights to play trumpet in 1973 at just 12 years old. He's now 71, but vividly remembers the days traveling the country and sleeping on high school gym floors.
When you describe this to people that were never in drum corps, they're going, that sounds terrible. You were sleeping in gym floors with no air conditioning in New Orleans? Yeah. Well, that sounds horrible. And everybody that was in will say, oh, it was the best time of my life.
Even though the Black Knights are no longer active, drum corps has a huge following throughout the region. It's standing room only as thousands of fans fill the stands at Belleville West High School, the site of tonight's rain-delayed competition. One of them is Rodney Williams, a 74-year-old fan from North St. Louis. He's at the show with his wife, Arlene, and says there's one corps he's really excited to see.
The Boston Crusaders, because they're neck-to-neck with the Bluecoats.
It's going to be one of those two that's going to win the entire thing.
The Bluecoats from Canton, Ohio aren't here tonight, but fans are still on the edge of their seats. Then the time comes.
Welcome to the field from Boston, Massachusetts, the Boston Crusaders!
A familiar moment for the members and the crowd. The ticking of a clock. The rush of speeding movement. A wall of brass. The Boston-based Corps takes first place at this one, but the season's far from over. The road to glory heads to Indianapolis for the World Championships. That's where a summer of sweat, sunburns, and standing ovations will come to a close, under the lights of Lucas Oil Stadium. In Belleville, I'm Brian Munoz.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us, and remember to join us next time for reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.